Look at it, Detective. One of the last of the rainforests. The world depends upon its oxygen, yet the rich see only profit in its destruction. You, who belong to the overclass, have much to answer for.
Bruce Wayne donates millions of dollars a year to preserve these forests.
Which are being depleted at the rate of 120,000 acres a day. Does your money solve this problem? No. It will take more than wealth. It will take power. And I fear, ruthlessness.
Welcome back to the show. As always, I am your host of ceremonies, Donovan MG. And as ever, he is the co-host of Celebrations, Harrison Chute.
The co-host of Celebrations. I like it.
I hope that's a thing. If it is not, then I heard it from somewhere else. In my brain. In the far corners of my blast absent memory. Once upon a time, we did an episode where we looked at the final awful episode of the original Star Trek series and an episode from the second season of Black Lagoon. Actually, three episodes of that series that were insidiously dark, and kind of compared them, kind of use them as examples of what media can give us in terms of representation, generally speaking, towards gender possibilities. And this, that's kind of in my mind going into this episode. It's not so much the exact same topic, but this episode involves sort of using media, using culture, and kind of broadcasting them towards the idea of how we might solve problems in the real world, which is dicey material to use. We're going to my abusive love, comic books, specifically DC comic books. And tonight we're going to be looking at three very particular comic books that were published, I think, between 1998 and 2001. These are comic books that were written by Paul Dini and illustrated by famous comic book painter Alex Ross. They are Superman, Peace on Earth, Batman, War on Crime, and Wonder Woman, Spirit of Truth. And right off the bat, I'll admit that I got this episode, ironically, similarly to the possibilities of storytelling episode from Mike and Dan from Earth2.net, because they did an episode of Earth2.net, the show, where they looked at all of the Alex Ross DC Comics stories, including these three, as well as Power of Shazam and a Justice League story. But I figured these three are a lot more sort of like geopolitical and kind of invite more analysis into sort of kind of in the realm that we kind of tend to talk about in terms of solving problems and questions that may not have answers. So I thought they might be an interesting discussion for tonight's episode. But we can kind of get into it. I don't know, Harry. I can't imagine you would have read these before, because I know comics aren't necessarily your wheelhouse. But is there anything you kind of want to kind of get into, or at least kind of bring up, like how you kind of took these comics before we kind of get into them separately and kind of address what they hope to address?
Yeah, I kind of got the impression that they were kind of like almost like a special event, although I don't know the context around them. And I know that Alex Ross is the artist, right?
Yes.
I think he had a story credit on all of them. So it seemed like this kind of like almost like a passion project. I mean, just to look at the actual artwork, obviously, you know, he's a guy who pours everything into it. But even beyond that, it was almost like this is something specific that a couple of people really wanted to explore with these characters. And for Superman and Batman, it definitely seemed like the kind of not apotheosis. I'm having one of those like bad vocabulary days. The words are not really coming. It seemed like kind of like the their quintessence, perhaps, that these were really good, almost like introductory stories to somebody who hadn't. Because for me, this is the first Superman comic I've ever read.
Okay.
I have read Batman and Wonder Woman in the past, but. So this was, it made sense, and I got an impression that was not like the movies, which everybody says, like, they haven't really done one of those in a while.
This felt like the idea of Superman for you?
Yeah, it really did.
Cool.
And, I mean, I don't want to sound like, use this as a pejorative, but it was almost like kind of like an after-school special approach.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, not in like a bad way, but I guess there's probably only, I mean, you think about like G.I. Joe in the window being like,
Captain Planet, I'm thinking of.
Beatboxing thing. Yeah, like Captain Planet.
Error.
But yeah, I mean, I think in doing that, you kind of, you weather some self-reflective questions about sincerity that I think eludes a lot of American creatives just in general, and perhaps in a kind of marginalized medium like comic books. But this kind of thinking about world problems is, you know, that's really, really interesting. And it's kind of aligning with a lot of the things that I'm trying to begin to explore in my own writing. And so the theories presented by these stories were, I guess it was kind of timely for me in terms of where I'm at with my creative work, which everybody wants to hear about, I'm sure. That's what people do on podcasts. But anyway, what is kind of your relationship to these works in the context of your comics fandom?
Well, I should it is a good point to kind of introduce them. I mean, Paul Dini just kind of he's not so much lesser of a name, but lesser of import in terms of this conversation, because he created Harley Quinn, and he was one of the major writers and later producers of like the DC animated shows, like Batman animated series, Superman animated series. So he's a pretty reliable DC writer. He's also a very funny guy, and he also wrote like scripts for like the Batman Arkham games, like two of them really. He's a really good writer. Generally speaking, so this is a writer who kind of comes to these characters knowing what to do with them, as opposed to I was going to say Zack Snyder, but like honestly, somebody who like you know who's it's not so much a PSA writer who comes to these characters and applies it to them. This is somebody who's a DC Comics writer, even though he was kind of relatively early in his career at this point. But really, these kind of made for the sake of Alex Ross. Alex Ross is a comic book fan turned pro who is a professional painter who really kind of made his name on the 1994 series Marvels, which was a four-part story written by Kurt Busiek, which was basically, it kind of made the idea of like, what if Marvel Comics was real, and sort of applied his realistic art style to like, you know, the comics of the 40s with Captain America and World War II. It's okay, well, let's go into the 60s where the Fantastic Four first appeared, and let's do the 70s where Spider-Man's fighting the Green Goblin. And kind of had the idea, like, well, if Marvel Comics was real from, like, the 40s to the 70s, what would they look like? And applied his very realistic art style and use of character models towards that, and it was a gigantic success. It also came around in the time where, like, you know, comic books had a really nasty reputation for being grimdark, and you had X-Men and Cable going all crazy, so it was very much like, wow, this is what they used to be like. and then 2 years later, it was sort of a similar story in DC with a story called Kingdom Come. It was sort of a Watchmen-esque possible end of the DC Universe story, where like, a lot of the characters were older, and you know the idea of what they kind of like, used to mean or whatever. But because of Ross's artwork and sort of the metatextual storytelling of it, that was even more successful and kind of just made him like a gigantic name in comic book industry. And he's done other things like. I think it's like, was it Earth X? He's currently, I mean, the last year or so, he's been doing covers for the Amazing Spider-Man title. And there's one story, which we should probably do an episode on in the future now that I'm thinking about it, called Uncle Sam, which was if the idea of, like, you know, sort of the Uncle Sam, you know, the, like, you know, the I want you kind of character, if he kind of existed and kind of saw America in, like, a modern 20th century, that. As I'm thinking about it right now, it's like, we probably should have done that. But, like, he's a comic book artist who is popular, as you might imagine, for his very photorealistic style, while also kind of capturing sort of the grand idea of these heroes in a way which should sort of, like, have them, as you say, like, the apotheosis of their iconography, as opposed to just drawing guys in costumes and stuff. So this is kind of, you know, the reason why these stories are made to kind of show what he could do, like the idea of like Superman flying a runaway train or Wonder Woman lifting a tank, in this sort of imagery, sort of sold the idea of these stories, and oh, that they can also carry a message too. If they, you know, if they look realistic, they should be doing things that might be realistic. I think is the idea.
Mm-hmm.
as I mentioned before, he did a couple other stories, like with the Captain Marvel character and the Justice League. But I figure like the Trinity, as it's called, the main three, are the ones which I think would make for a good episode. So yeah, we can kind of get into it. I have these stories. I have a collection of Alex Ross stories, but I don't know where they are.
Nice.
So you and I have read these online. Is it here? No, there are boxes of crap because I have way too many things. But I've had these stories for about maybe a decade. But I've not read them a lot, so this is the first time I've read them in a while, so we can get into it. And I'm sure we'll go with these one at a time, like we did with the last media review / discussion episode.
Yeah.
So we should start where DC Comics ought to start, not with Batman, but with Superman.
Yes.
This is, you know, a brief synopsis, Superman, Peace on Earth. This is essentially a story where Superman tries to solve the problem of world hunger, and... By and large, I mean, you know, after an introductory flashback where he's, you know, he grew up on a farm with Ma Kent. We see him encounter a starving girl, Metropolis, and this is during the Christmas season. So, as Clark Kent, he investigates the causes and roots and instances of world hunger, and thinks back to what his father told him about sharing what they have and kind of basically being responsible with their powers. So, Superman essentially appeals to Congress to give him a couple of days to travel the world and just try to solve world hunger, or at least provide an example for solving world hunger. He thinks if he can at least give food to the needy, people with other powers can kind of lend their example, people with political powers. So he travels to Africa, he travels to the Southwest, he travels to Brazil, and tries to make his example known. Eventually he runs into sort of, you know, military powers and sort of world dictators who are less pleased that he's trying to solve their nation's problems. And although he stops a couple of them, he runs into a situation, and these countries are never named explicitly, but eventually he runs into a situation where the gigantic yacht full of food that he's carrying is destroyed and the food is poisoned, and that effectively ends his journey. He basically realizes that he's failed. He cannot seriously solve the world's problems, but just kind of delivering the answers on a silver platter. So he tries to figure out a meaning to this, and in the background we're told that people are kind of debating the purpose and quality of his mission. So he basically tries to kind of start small and offers to show school children how to farm and hope that they can learn how to kind of grow food, kind of share with others what they've learned, share their knowledge. And he puts his faith in people and put his trust in people. He'll bet, you know, eventually the problem of world hunger will sort of be solved with the future. And that's pretty much the story in how, in this story, he might combat world hunger. So, Harry, I guess, because I think I'll be asking you the majority of these questions for this episode. Overall, how did you take to this approach in Superman solving problems, and how do you think how effective do you think it was as a storytelling method for this problem?
I mean, I love this exact kind of story. If you could kind of extrapolate it to a formula, the idea of like, I mean, I think probably people would call it like a Don Quixote or Quixotic. I don't know if that's pronounced the same, but you know, the idea of like a Sisyphean task being undertaken by one person. I feel like sometimes, even though that's always what storytelling is always kind of, it's just kind of like individualistic and especially for Americans, I suppose, heroism is often contained in the individual, but right. In this case, it's more literalized. And I think that that's cool because you can really address actual problems. I mean, I might kind of ascribe a label to it, like it's almost like a utopian kind of story. Mm-hmm. And I think I've always liked those stories, but they are also not really in evidence. They don't really exist, but they are always there. They're the kind of stories that are like suggested by the end of the movie. Like if you have a police procedural and they're like trying to solve a murder, they realize that, you know, they solve the murder, but they realize that, you know, the society is like right. all messed up, but you know, it's Chinatown, Jake, and so they just have to like go away. But what happens, like, what if you actually tried to solve that part of it? And so you have Superman who can, you know, fight supervillains and punch meteors, and so you think, well, maybe he can do it. And so obviously with a story like this, if you're coming into it as a writer, you're not going to have Superman literally solve world hunger. because world hunger
surprising.
Is, I know, yeah, and it wouldn't have any relevance to the real world in which Superman does not exist and did not solve world hunger. So I think the approach or the conclusion is always that he can't do it, but you learn a lesson to put forward into the actual effort. And it proceeds that way. It's also worth noting that the three stories we're going to be talking about are. Probably the comic term is like a one shot.
Yes.
But they're effectively short stories in terms of like a more general.
Or like this isn't like Superman issue 693 or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, nor is it like a mini series or a TV season length.
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah. It's like literally a one shot. That's right.
Yeah. So there's only so much you can do, but. But I think there's a great economy of storytelling going on. And to get a little bit more specific, one of the interesting aspects of it is that he goes around to the world and as you say, he kind of encounters different kinds of opposition, the most notable being the kind of the military dictatorship being like, you know, we're just – I guess you'd probably call them warlords being
right.
like – you know, we're going to take all the food for ourselves. And then Superman tries to give the food to the people, but they like shoot the food or something. And so what I think also each of these heroes being like fundamentally American in so many different ways, even Wonder Woman, who's Amazonian, but she shows up in like this, you know, ridiculous red, white, and blue regalia.
what the?
Yeah, which I mean, I had kind of forgotten because I last saw that movie from last year in which they kind of toned that down or made her more logical with Amazon.
They've because in the comics, her costume is just like the movie now. They do mm-hmm. it sometimes. And like, it's a little bit more, it's slightly more armored up. Whereas this is the more, the general, like this version of the costume she's had for like decades.
Right. And it's, I mean, and it's a little garish or whatever, but it makes sense in that story when we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But Superman being an American character in more ways than one, it's interesting how, you know, we are the kind of interventionalist nation who goes into other places and tries to solve problems, sometimes for our own benefit. But, you know, theoretically, there's always something to be gained when you have this much power and wealth to share that around. Not usually with the military, but I mean, that's just how it goes, unfortunately. But the point is that he bounces against truly different cultures. And I think that to kind of to recognize that that's what's going on in the world, that you can't kind of apply an American mindset broadly and just say, well, why can't everybody just think the way I am? Because that would solve it. If everybody thought exactly like Superman and wanted the same thing, then yes. But even he in the beginning is like, I feel like this is going to be ridiculous, but I'm just going to try it. And even people in Congress are like, this is kind of ridiculous. So he knows that it's bigger than him. And so a fundamental question also from that is why is that? Because one of the early notes is from his father is that there's enough food in the world to feed everyone. So, but everybody isn't being fed. Unfortunately, I don't think that that question is really addressed by mm-hmm. Superman's journey, but we can get into that too.
Yeah, I definitely hope to kind of critique and kind of see how if this story pushed as far as it could have. It's funny because like the idea, one of the very first ideas of Superman that the person who learns of him is you know he's so powerful and so good. Why isn't he just solve the world's problems? And of course, you know as everybody who has an ego likes to say off of that when he first was created, he was very much like created to kind of fulfill that fantasy. Like, he was a guy who could beat up slumlords and, you know, abusive husbands and people who kind of pick on the little guy. He was very much he was not more of an aggressive person who fought the world's problems, created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And that's kind of been an idea that, like, has never really been abandoned by the character, by and large. I mean, the idea is that, like, you know, more than any other hero, Superman solves disasters. He solves problems that no one else can solve. You know, the Flash runs fast, Aquaman fights the sea's enemies or whatever. I know more than that, but I'm not going to say it. But, like, Superman, like he will be the one to kind of stop an earthquake or stop or a volcano from destroying a city. So, like, this is kind of that idea taken to its realistic end game. And, like, it's kind of funny because, like, generally the stories, at least in continuity, don't really get into that, at least in the modern times. Because I'm thinking, like, you know, the movies did get into this a little bit. Like, Superman 4, not well-loved.
Famous, the Quest for Peace.
The Quest for Peace, yeah. Like, the point of this, and this is from Christopher Reeve's, this is an idea Christopher Reeve had, is that Superman wants to, like, ban all nuclear weapons on the planet, which no one would have stand for, realistically. You think they all be for it, but, like, that's insane. And there's literally a scene, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's literally a scene where him, like, having every nuclear weapon in a gigantic net, and he just throws in the sun.
Dude, that's the plot of Sunshine.
And then for some reason, Lex Luthor creates Nuclear Man, blah, blah, blah. But, like, yeah. And then, like, in Batman v Superman Dawn, this is, like, the only time I actually mentioned that, and it's relevant. Like, in Dawn of Justice, there's legitimately, the first half of that movie, the plot is, you know, if Superman's so powerful, how does he decide what to do? And there's this, like, this depressing montage of him, like, you know, saving people and looking horrified as he does it. Honestly, yes. like Zack Snyder has been quoted saying that, like, a lot of his super imagery is borrowed from Alex Ross Superman drawings.
I noticed that. Yeah. Did notice that.
You can absolutely. I was reminded of that because Superman in Ross isn't done in the sort of the kind of cartoony smiling kind of way, but he's not nearly as, like, homicidal as,
right,
as Snyder tells Henry Cavill to play it, but like there is very much sort of like a God among men imagery to it, mm-hmm. Even though the writing and the characterization position it specifically that he's a man trying to do good with his godlike powers as opposed to a god figuring out how to deal with these annoying men.
What is human?
Yeah, exactly. It's a damn shame because I think that I appreciate the approach, but, like, yeah, I think this one is a bit more intelligent with how to approach it because it goes from a character perspective.
Oh, yeah.
This is a Superman story in all the best kinds of ways. Like, this is a it's not an ego trip concern of his. It's just, you know, I want to really do something about this. I mean, how did you go into this story? I'm sure you had no idea about what it was going to be like, but how did you go into this kind of imagining how it might turn out? And were you surprised in the way that the story turned out, or did you think that, like, this kind of played close to form about how you might imagine a Superman story might be?
I mean, I think I recognized a bit of a formula, like, midway through. A story like this can only end a certain number of ways, which is probably true for all storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, they say there's only two stories ever told, which is a hero goes on a journey and a stranger comes to town, which, of course, is right. The same story. But in this case, like, it's going to build toward a moral. And for whatever reason, I always hope that there's more focus on process in all things. Puberty. But there's a little bit of that. Again, it's important to note that this is a short story, and so I think what you can accomplish is really identify problems. And so I think, honestly, the story goes a little bit extra by providing a kind of not so much like a practical answer, but a message almost of encouragement that it's almost like you don't have to be Superman to solve world hunger, but you have to, like Superman, care enough about your fellow man to work towards that problem. And that is a problem worth addressing because look at the different people he encounters and the very human faces who are suffering. But in terms of what was I expecting, my interpretation of Superman is just, and it's even worse for Batman, of course, but my interpretation of Superman has just been so twisted by the movies. Even though I've only really, it's like Superman in trailers for a while since Superman Returns from 04 or 05, I think.
06, yeah.
Which I don't remember anything about other than he got shot in the eyeball.
I was just about to say, yeah.
That's the only thing. But, you know, I mean, the more recent takes on Superman, I mean, I think it's probably a comparison that people are like eye rolling at, but it's so astute because they're just so opposite approaches to the character. And honestly, like, it's such a, like, Ghost in the Shell 95 versus 2017 dichotomy, because it just, the Zack Snyder, or really, what's his name? Mr. Dark City, Blade Trinity. David Goyer. Yeah. It's such a David Goyer thing, but it makes Superman seem less intelligent. Whereas in this story, he really seems like a thoughtful guy, rather than an alien in the most, like, Merriam-Webster definition, like, he's just an alien. Whereas in this, like, he is somebody who deals with that. Like, he feels alien. Like, I really got the sense that, oh yeah, like, he's an adopted kid. And that's, I mean, that has to come from feelings of marginalization that the two creators that you had mentioned, like, you know, they were Jewish guys living in America in, like, a period in which was bad for Jews, which was all the time. And, like, it makes sense that a story like that would come from, you know, humanity rather than and hope and stuff like that. So, again, this does feel like a quintessential story, whereas the Zack Snyder stuff feels like it's kind of like he wanted to do the Frank Miller revision at the beginning. But, again, those movies aren't on trial here, even though they may always be in our minds and in our hearts because they're pretty bad.
I am trying not to just fall into bashing those movies because it's not fair, I just feel like, you know, they might, oh, they're talking about Superman, oh, they hate me, but like we're talking about these stories now, but yeah, I think that, like, you can read this story and at least appreciate what Superman is doing without feeling like, you know, for anybody who kind of goes into like, oh, well, Superman, you know, he's this boring hero who has nothing against him, his character comes through in this, even though this is kind of done in a prose story in some ways, very illustrative prose story, his actions drive his character drives his actions, and that's, even though that's kind of, he's always just trying to solve world hunger, everyone wants to do that, but like, it's, I don't know, it is very quintessential. I mean, I like this story. I think that, like, I don't think I've read an Alex Ross comic that I've not liked, but like, I really appreciate, kind of just how, like, intelligent all the heroes are kind of depicted in this. But I do want to ask, do you think that this story went far enough in terms of what he could have done, at least in a sort of a trial attempt to kind of solve world hunger? Do you think that, like, was there anything that kind of, like, stuck in, well, he could do this or this or this, in terms of, like, you know, the opposition he kind of came up against, or anything? Like, did anything come to mind in terms of, like, either how he would have done it or what Superman could have thought about? At least in this story, not so much, you know, in terms of, like, you know, the next day or whatever, but do you feel that, like, this story, with all that Superman could do, went far enough in terms of, you know, really, really, really trying to solve world hunger?
I mean, he doesn't, so I guess not, right? But I guess you just have to kind of be telling a different story. So in terms of really getting into that, I guess we would have to brainstorm, like, how world hunger is solved just theoretically, and then would Superman be capable of that? And so the problem that even in the context of the story, the problem is a matter of distribution primarily, and then you kind of get into the issues of I guess it's always distribution and access and the control of food, that it's not so much that this is a problem that just comes from nowhere, kind of like crime is a little bit treated in the Batman story, but we'll get there. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would ask you, or we could just kind of just think about it together. Why is it, because I didn't do the research, why is it that food isn't distributed as fairly as everything else is, which is, you know, nothing is distributed fairly in the world, of course, but why food of all things?
Yeah, I meant to do research and I didn't. but I was thinking, like, you know, he runs up into a country which is pretty plainly to see, without any flags waving around, North Korea.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're thinking, okay, and this is something that he had to expect would happen eventually. But it's one of those things where it's like, you know, if Superman existed, would he just not overthrow this guy?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was, it wasn't in the comic, but it was in sort of like this, like, sort of like, I think this comic strip, which was even in the 40s out of continuity, where he straight up like went out and captured Hitler and Stalin, and yeah. And like, threw them into like the world powers, like, and that was like, you know, I mean, Superman was just one gigantic fantasy of Siegel and Shuster. I think even Lois Lane was like, you know, kind of drawn up as a girl that like one of them eventually married. so he's like the biggest fanfic character ever, but at that point, I remember specifically this is the point that kind of killed the story for Dan and Mike on Earth too. Like this kind of made them not like this Superman story. Is that like when he saved the people from getting shot by like the warlord's men, he just leaves, and like the next day those guys are dead.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Whoops. But it's one of those things, and like you know, he does like melt the guns with his heat vision. But like, it is one of those things where it's like, it's American interventionalism kind of when it's convenient for them, in a way, and it's hard because there's not really an answer to that. And it's like, well, you either deal with this to kind of show how countries would respond to this, but that's not like. It's like a part one. It kind of bleeds into another different story, one of which you're not trying to tell, but one which, now that you've introduced this element, which is realistic, you kind of have to follow up with another realistic consequence. Mm-hmm. And I'm not nearly as annoyed at that sort of like writing dead end as I think they were with respect to them. But like, I do think that like it does beg the question: is like he genuinely leaving them to their fate, and it's kind of like what he said. Again, I don't know if any of the countries are sort of named, but like there's at one point when he was giving out food, and a child had said, "Will you be back tomorrow?" And he says he kind of has like this kind of look away and not answer him, which is kind of chilling. But that is the sort of thing where it's like, why can't you do that tomorrow? Why can't he continue? Because this is sort of treated as like, you know, almost not as cynically, but almost kind of a curiosity. You know, what can I do with my powers? And then, like, not making that his mission from now on. Although he knows that, like, if he does dedicate himself to that, it will probably upend the world into some sort of new sort of war, just because between different warring countries. And again, that's not the story that this story was meaning to tell. But at the same time, it kind of makes the story, turn the story into something where it is sort of seen as a gigantic half-measure, which might let the potential down. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think with a story like this, there's always the possibility that it could just be completely desolate or whatever, that the conclusion reached is that this cannot be solved. Mm-hmm. Superman failed. Like, I think I was partial. I mean, I didn't think it was going that direction, but that is kind of like the pit that you could have fallen into as the storyteller. And yeah, it's true. I mean, cause it's just because it is so complicated that world hunger isn't two words, that it's this, it's like every problem, it's always interconnected to everything. Mm-hmm. If you took out all the warlords and threw them into the sun, perhaps, that would be a problem because you would create a power vacuum or something. And I think, I mean, people are even talking about that in North Korea, like you can't just invade, I mean, for obvious reasons, but we just don't understand that country well enough. I mean, could Superman make that into like his full-time job? Yeah, but that would occupy all of him, and so he would only be able to do that if Metropolis was attacked by Godzilla. Like, I know what happens in one of those cartoons. You know, what's he gonna do? Like, he can't be everywhere at once. And that's I don't know how to kind of square that problem because it tracks so well with kind of people's empathy budgets. That there's right. just this moment of paralysis when you're kind of trying to think about all the world problems. And at some point, you just have to be like, you just have to walk away. You're like, I can't fucking deal. I wanted to do one thing, but it was connected to the next thing and the next thing. And I realized that to solve one problem, you have to solve all the problems. And so it can't be done. And so that's the story that could have been told, but it isn't. And so I do want to kind of hone in on that moral, which is, Well, I can't really remember it, but it was like
it's important to do something rather than nothing, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that I don't want to say, oh, it's better than nothing. It's not quite like The Wire, which is like so specific and like, if you want to solve the drug war, this is what you have to do. Like specifically, this is what you have to do, which is really cool. But I mean, that's rare. I think this is more about emotion and character. I mean, because it's a character study. It feels that way. And it's more about saying these are the qualities you would need. The kind of courage in the human spirit to address these problems. So it's not how, but kind of like what you need and almost why, I think, too. Not that – I mean, because sometimes, you know, problems like this become kind of platitudinous or something. It's like, oh, it's world hunger. It's like the cure to cancer. Just this impossible thing that even Superman can't solve. It's interesting, and I do kind of want to move past this one because it feels like we're just kind of – or at least I'm just kind of going around in circles saying like, well, it's the only story you could tell in that framework, but I'm interested. And I think the conclusion they draw, it's a little half-measury, but it's worthwhile because of what it says. It definitely doesn't lay out a real solution.
But it doesn't come off lazy, though.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't come off like you said, platitudinous, where it's like, you know, like well, you can't give up kind of thing. I mean, it might, but like it feels if it is that way, it does a good job not putting that right out there. and I have a better opinion of Paul Dini than that. I think that like the actual, I won't say the problem, but like the element that prevents Superman from turning this into a completely different story is the fact that he is Clark Kent. Like, this is... And this is the verse of Superman that, like, that has primarily been kind of solidified since 1985, and famously they don't really do this in the movies, which kind of makes... Well, a lot of Superman fans aren't happy with the movies, is that, like, the idea is that Clark Kent is the person, and Superman is the identity he assumes to solve problems, whereas generally, for, like, the first 40 years or so, Clark Kent was a secret identity that Superman used to kind of just be a news reporter and kind of learn about problems as they happen. But Superman was like, you know, the prevailing persona. But like a very key image in this is like when he's at his apartment, he has his glasses on and his kind of shirt, but he has the Superman tights, just kind of leaning back in the chair, looking very exhausted and kind of defeated. Like it's a visual symbol for like, you know, this is Clark Kent. He's not Superman 24/7. And I think that like, showing him thinking about his father and thinking about what he learned gives you the idea that he is imbued with a human's sort of empathy budget, a human sort of spirit, and human sort of weariness that he can't – he knows that he can't solve everything even though he potentially has the power to be able to. His mind might mean to be able to withstand it, which is implicit, but it's not explored as much as it could be. But I think by the very nature of that character kind of – I don't want to say gives it an out, but kind of explains – why he doesn't, you know, overthrow North Korea dictatorship or whatever. The story I think the story's kind of meant to be like, you know, well, this is supposed to at least give attention to this instance rather than just be a story of real-life heroes, you know, kind of doing what they want to solve the world. But because that involves real-world situations, it kind of can make the reader feel a little bit burned. I don't feel necessarily burned, but, like, I think that, like, that's a fair response. Because, like, you know, there's a scene where, you know, there are other countries that he didn't get to that are waiting for him to kind of show up, which is a downer. I think what that shows is the disappointment in basically, like, trying and not finishing what you start. But also just kind of like, you know, you need to really consider how to solve world hunger and really kind of consider how to go up with that process. And it might mean kind of upending the very nature of the world and kind of geopolitical situations and even the dreaded comic industry itself. And inviting that idea might be disheartening for a comic book reader, but I think it's an interesting storytelling exercise. And I think that like, if you're going to tell a one-shot story, it's worth telling that, even if it is, even if, because I can see people saying, well, this just tried to impress us with its attention to detail and kind of come away from it without solving anything, and for that, it sucks. But I think, should Noah Wolanski say that, then it would, I don't know, it just kind of just lends itself towards, I think that depends on your opinion of this, superhero genre as a whole, rather than just kind of taking this as one story. And that might be up to, like, you know, an individual reader.
And I think, I mean, what you were saying about, like, upending the industry, like, part of the problem, or part of the reason why Superman doesn't solve world hunger in the end, is because this is kind of an outlier in Superman comics, or comics in general. It is quintessential in one respect, but it's also not what Superman has kind of become to a broader audience, like as he's represented in film. He's not fighting a supervillain. He doesn't really fight anybody, really. He melts a few guns, but that's kind of it. And so this isn't a go-to story for fiction in general. You know, finding a problem and really trying to work out a solution. Like, usually it's a different kind of, not storytelling, but just story focus. And we don't see a lot of stories like that. I wish there were more like that. You know, I wish that, like, Ghost in the Shell season 3 existed and it was more like this. And
painted by Alex Ross.
Painted by, yeah. Oh, man. Interesting. And, you know, my conception of what Crazy Ex-Girlfriend season 4 is going to be is more like, you know, kind of unprecedented in TV and storytelling, like a character, like, really reconciling the creation of a better world. And, you know, I appreciate storytellers who are interested in that, because I think that it can be seen as naive or dumb or whatever. Again, sincerity, I think, is a huge element with all of these things. But it is what kind of makes it rare. And another thing is also, I like that in all three of these stories, there's really no, like, racism or anything, or I almost said swearing. I was like, oh, I love how puritanical this story is. No, it's just like, it's not like grimdark either, but mostly it's just like, they're all very international, and they encounter different kinds of people, but he always kind of recognizes the kind of the same needs and desires and suffering in the people. And so it's not like, they don't really even say the names of countries, but you see, like, the statue that people know, like, it's Rio from.
Yeah, the Jesus statue, yeah. Rio de Janeiro. Yeah, Rio de Janeiro, yeah.
Stuff like that. Like, it's subtle, but it's not to say that, like, national identities are unimportant, but it's that, you know, we're all – it's one world, man.
Well, I think there's power in kind of, you know, demonstrating what it is without coming out and saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes it more relatable without kind of, like, you know, specifying it. There's something about storytelling, about in terms of show, like, literally showing and not telling, that has a greater kind of resonant weight to it. So I know exactly what you're saying. He doesn't say that he needs to, you know, do that, or like Wonder Woman being in China. They just kind of show that and sort of let the prose work for itself, while the images kind of, you know, the images are so detailed that you're not wanting to know, well, which country is this? Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Although, I mean, the Wonder Woman one laid it on a little thick with the tank in the Chinese streets. Like, huh, I wonder what this is in reference to. We'll get there.
I have one last point, but did you have anything else about Superman Peace on Earth? Any other point?
No, I mean, it's cool, and I'd like to follow up on Superman. I mean, I've had designs to do that for a while, just because I feel like his kind of mythological resonance goes a little bit beyond the matters of, like, DC universes and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's interesting. And a lot of interesting writers, Alan Moore included, and stuff like that, have kind of addressed that and found interesting things to say there. So, yeah, Superman's cool, but my Superman education is just so poorly attended to by, obviously, Hollywood, which is my first contact for most things.
Yeah, he's a fascinating character, and, like, I mean, I would say even more so than Batman, he's been kind of done in so many different ways. Like, he was like, you know, pretty nationalistic. As you might imagine, during World War II, and in the 50s, he kind of became this wacky sci-fi character.
Yeah.
And in the 70s, kind of became this more kind of, like, not to say person, but, you know, he was like a television reporter for like the 70s and like in the 80s and the whole thing. Like, there's so many different iterations of him that are fun and entertaining, but it's I find it hard to kind of pick out which one to kind of go for, even the stuff that I really like or was introduced to. So at this point, if anybody's interested, I would just kind of recommend the various podcasts by Michael Bailey, who is like the world's greatest Superman fan, and a really cool guy. I've worked with him a number of times, and I would just kind of defer to him in terms of where to start. But the last thing I want to do, and I want to kind of do this with all three of these, is like, what did you make of the artwork? How do you in terms of, like, you know, any specific scenes or how Superman was physically depicted? Like, I'm interested to know, because there's a lot of detail in a lot of this. Like, what was your takeaway of Ross's artwork, specifically with this story?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, my experience with comic books often is manga, in which you kind of budget your, or even in anime, this is all, you kind of budget your detail. Sometimes that means like black and white or colored images, but usually you'll have like a big splash image and it's like, oh, wow, that's cool. You don't have a lot of like Katsuhiro Otomo's or Kentaro Miura's. And so in this case, and so you I feel like you kind of develop this understanding that like you're going to break out the really great art for the really important moment. And so when the whole thing looks like it was carved out of woodcut or wood, it's like, it's just kind of weird. There are no small moments. Which, I mean, maybe, you know, storytelling doesn't need small moments in the way we traditionally think about that. And so you have this moment where you're kind of looking down from Superman's perspective, and it's like a New York City street. There's like a Christmas tree and it's snowing, and it just looks, not out of a movie, but like out of a dream. And it's cool. And so I guess I don't really bring the kind of, readership lexicon to kind of parse a lot of the imagery, where I do with film, for example. But in this case, it's like, well, what am I getting from this? I don't exactly know yet. So I'd have to probably read it again. But for now, I guess I would just say that it's a marvel to look at. And, it doesn't, at the same time, it doesn't distract from the story. Like, I wasn't just like paging through it as fast as I could just to see the next one. It was somehow balanced in that regard, which is probably a hidden skill for the artist.
Yeah. Ross, he's known that he does do a lot of like models for his works, and I think that his Superman one has been pretty consistent. Kingdom Come takes place like 10 years after the future of DC Universe, where Superman's kind of older, but he looks kind of the same as Superman. and sometimes he uses like celebrities for other people, but like generally, yeah. Even though these are sort of photorealistic, you don't feel that like. You don't feel a sort of a lack of work or detail into them. Like what I love is that he uses so many different angles and so many sort of side angles and Dutch angles that he can show people from kind of below their noses and stuff and kind of up above them. So it really feels realistic. Yeah. And he has these characters in their classic costumes, but they don't look. I mean, I don't think they look too goofy.
Right.
There's no sense of compromise in this. Mm. That I really enjoy, and his Superman. I mean, I've heard people kind of comment on this. And I can kind of parse it ourselves. There's a very, very. I actually kind of noticed it more when Clark appeared in the Wonder Woman thing. But like, there's an ever so slight touch of Chris Reeve in his face. But he's generally. He's a very kind of like adult Superman. Like he looks like he's no. I mean, he's no younger than 40 in this, and that's very much the classic kind of patriarchal take on Superman, which was made famous in the Silver and Bronze Age by an artist named Kurt Swan, who was kind of like the premier Superman artist pretty much all of his life, which kind of had Superman kind of do this sort of patriarchal kind of the classical stuff, like when Supergirl first appeared and like Brainiac and those kind of characters in the 50s and 60s. Superman looked like this, where he looked like the lead in a 50s sitcom, although here he's a lot more kind of bulky and stuff. And I kind of like that, because he doesn't look like he's out of shape or too old, but he looks – you're not seeing this as like, well, he looks too young or too old. He looks very much kind of aspirational, I suppose. He has a double chin at times. He doesn't look like he's flawless, but he also looks like he's big and imposing, and that he embodies a realistic body while still being a Superman body.
Mm-hmm. What was that meme? It was like, this is what the ideal – masculine body looks like deal with it or whatever. That was me fun. It is kind of that, but you know, it works.
Yeah, and he has a really good attention to detail in stories. Like, I like in the flashback scene, or one of his, Clark's thoughts when he's remembering what his father told him, you notice, like, young Clark is, like, sitting up very straight. And you can imagine that, like, his like, Pa Kent would have told him to do that when he's talking to his elders or whatever. Like, there's a lot of details in these stories that you kind of parse out in terms of, like, you know, how they would kind of carry themselves. Like, in the next story, the guy that Bruce Wayne is talking to, I think his name is, like, Winters or whatever, he has kind of, like, very baggy, ill-fitting suit, which kind of, you know, dictates a note, sort of like a sleazy persona. While Bruce's suit is very tailored and very straight and everything, he has kind of this sort of powerful alpha kind of posture. So there's a lot of consideration. It's not just, you know, the kind of the detail and the people, but, like, there's a lot of kind of consideration to how would they move and stuff. And when Superman flies, he's very prostrate and straight without any sort of, you know, like, hint of, like, wire work or anything. So that stuff I always come back to Alex Ross for. Like, what do we not tend to see in a Jim Lee artwork or a Todd Knock artwork? Or this kind of stuff that's more traditional.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. Yeah. So, like, Superman, it's my question, please. It definitely lends oneself to think what could they have done more, but I like it as is, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the second of our trifecta of stories, Batman War on Crime. This story involves Batman kind of musing on how he relates to the normal people in Gotham City, the criminals, and the victims of crime. And this culminates in an encounter he has with an orphan whose parents were killed in a mugging, which, as you might imagine, could come close to home for him. And Batman doesn't really do anything about this after he catches the killer. But simultaneously, there's a thing going on at Wayne Enterprises where a guy has an idea for basically a gentrification project in this place called Bayside. And Bruce is recognizing the impact he could have, and that effect could have on the people in terms of how crime has kind of come up with in terms of desperation, in terms of lack of community, lack of jobs. And he's thinking about a lot of this, but he doesn't really do much until he runs into the boy whose name is Marcus again and again. And he kind of slips into crime, you know, for lack of parents. And Batman talks him out of being a criminal, essentially. And ultimately, Wayne decides to use the... Basically use his funds to kind of start up some jobs in Bayside and try to help a small community guy get it back on his feet and kind of try to help the people that way through his Bruce Wayne persona while he still continues to fight crime as Batman. Acknowledging that, you know, this might be sort of a Pyrrhic victory or even sort of a thing that he can never really win, but he's going to keep on trying. And he still believes in people. As angry as he is, he still believes in people of Gotham City and hopes for some sort of, like, peace when all is said and done.
The city just showed you they're willing to believe in good.
You'll be a bad cell forever. He also looks and sounds like Christian Bale. Would you believe? Harry, I'm curious what you thought about this. What was your take on Batman War on Crime?
Oh, man. So many thoughts. I feel like this is kind of like a great prototypical story to just have at the center of, like, any conversation about American crime, because, oh God, where to begin? I mean, I kind of want to start at the beginning or at the end, where, you know, what's interesting about the kid character is that his parents are murdered, and he kind of, you know, the next time you see him, he's, like, working at this, like, drug factory, and Batman confronts him and disarms him, you know, de-escalates, and the kid, like, runs away or whatever. That's the part where he convinces him not to be a criminal, which is another part. But it's important that or there's a kind of implicit commentary going on by making his origin story essentially so close to Batman's that what is really the difference here? Isn't Batman essentially a criminal? And legally, yes. I think vigilantism is illegal in Gotham as it would be everywhere else in America.
Oh, yes, but they don't care.
yeah, I know. That's always an interesting touch, how you have Winters kind of saying, like, well, that's the problem for the cops and Batman. Like, he's just kind of this accepted piece of the world. But the problem is, you know, Batman says at one point, like, he kind of accepts that there's a kind of inevitability of people falling into crime, that criminals are essentially victimized by crime, which is in many cases true, and certainly in this kind of understanding of crime, which is like drug dealers in the inner city. That is a stable truth. But in the end, the answer is just don't do it. But there's no suggestion of what the kid is going to do otherwise, other than he's not doing crime. And that's not going to fly. Like the reason why people fall into crime is because they have nothing else. And there's a lot of money in drugs, like a lot of money. And so unfortunately you can't just beat the crap out of drug dealers and make the problem go away. However, it's not really Batman who's kind of the ultimate hero in the story, but Bruce Wayne, because what he does is use his resources as a developer, essentially. And he puts a lot of money into revitalizing a piece of this neighborhood Bayside, and hopefully can kind of turn that around. And the problems presented by a character like Winters is that there's no profit in doing this. One of the lines is like, you know, the profit would be small, but the human spirit would be like incalculable or whatever. And really it's the same when we were kind of theorizing about what the problem is behind world hunger and distribution in the previous story. Like, I think it is a matter of there is simply no profit in being humanitarian. Like, all of our great organizations are nonprofits, and there's just no, for whatever reason, the economic, like, not to go all like Twitter libertarian, but all the systems that we've built around ourselves simply do not make the human individual their bottom line. It's something more strange and selfish and Randian. But so in this case, you kind of have there's a more direct approach to that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think the element of street crime is not really it's not quite addressed in a complex manner that I would hope, I guess.
Yeah, there was space for them to get just a little bit more specific in terms of, like, you know, how one does a step-by-step process in terms of urban crime.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that, like, I think that all three stories are certainly not, you know, well, here's the answer. Why doesn't everybody read these and kind of, you know, follow protocol? But they are sort of an exploration into their various themes. I think that, like, what I like about this is that, like, this is a little bit less interventionist than this Superman. Like, Batman doesn't really necessarily do anything that he doesn't already do until, like, the very end of the story. It's a lot more kind of a thoughtful musing on the various dimensions of crime. You know, crime touched him, crime touches other people on the daily. And he's kind of almost kind of like mournful, or at least kind of more kind of brutally accepting about how it happens. But, like, it doesn't necessarily pause him or stop him, but it does make him think of, you know, different ways to kind of go about intervening in crime, which I think is really cool. I mean, I talk to you about Batman all the time, on and off the show, but, like, this is kind of how I grew up seeing the character. Before the Nolan movies, where, like, the popular version of the character is a lot more shouty and angry, the way I see Batman, the kind of way that kind of came up with the anime series and basically all the comic books until 2011, is that there's a real nobility to the character that's kind of demonstrated in his thought process. It's not like how Wolverine is kind of said to be, have a noble spirit, even though he never does. But, like, he's a character who is really smart and is really acknowledging of his own kind of failures and flaws and kind of the realities of situations. Like there's a very famous quote from Brad Meltzer back when he was a comic writer and not a novelist, where Batman said, "I know what I'm doing, and every day I do it could be the last day where I decide to stop it. But it won't be today, and it won't be tomorrow either." Like people say, you know, "Oh yeah, well, he's just insane." Like, he's not somebody who doesn't understand what he's doing, but he is kind of, it is sort of an emotional thing for him. But here, a lot of that is sort of kind of laid out in front of him, and he observes it and kind of comments on it. And as a result, it kind of lends itself to kind of thinking about crime in a way which I feel makes sense for the character. I mean, I think all these make sense for the characters, but, like, this one, it's complicated because, like with Superman, he has a lot of wealth that could really, if he didn't spend his money on Batmobiles and Kevlar capes and stuff, he could probably totally reinvent Crime Alley or the Narrows or whatever, and kind of make Gotham the way that like his parents tried to. But he's just too full of vengeance to want to do that. But it's interesting to kind of see how he kind of channel his spirit elsewhere. The biggest sort of like hang up that I have the story, and like you mentioned before, how like there's not a lot of like continuity in these stories, and that's true. These are pretty much standalone, and I think that they're better for it. But there's a kid here, there's a black kid here who loses his parents to crime. And as Batman predicts, he keeps on running into him as he's falling into crime. It's one of those things where, like that hits so close to Batman that, like, you would imagine he would be a little bit more interventionist in that. Like, kind of, and maybe after the story, he would kind of, like, you know, have him in some sort of, like, you know, high fancy adoption agency or a tutoring tool, or I don't know, adopt him himself.
Yeah, he does that, doesn't he?
Well, I mean. The second Robin, Jason Todd, literally was a street urchin who like ripped off the Batmobile tires, and like Batman's like, well, if I don't do something to him now, I'll be fighting him in 10 years. So let me adopt him, and yeah, why not make him Robin? Mm. So I was like, so why can't he adopt the black kid?
I know the answer. let me stop right there. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that is, and that's, you know. That is sort of mixing continuities and whatever. And Jason Todd is sort of a specific case, but like honestly, that I can't help but think that whenever I read this story, like you just adopt him. He tends to do that. But I think that like I won't say so much half measures, but like it feels like Batman, what he does is always to the fullest of his interest and energy, rather than trying to kind of seek solutions and not being able to find them. Mm-hmm. And I think that made the story interesting. Although this one. Honestly, it's not so much concerned, but like it, I think the exploratory nature of this story and its relationship to like, you know, real world crime is very engaging to read. Even though I feel that it's less aspirational than the Superman story was.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Which doesn't make it a lesser story. I think it's certainly relevant to American interests or whatever. But I hate to keep bringing it back to the Zack Snyder movies, but I think those are just such useful examples of like the extremist end of an interpretation of Batman, where you have him like, you know, setting up criminals to die in prison or get murdered or whatever.
Yeah, he would never do that.
Yeah, and it's hard to kind of to square these two Batmans together. Like they just seem so wildly disparate. Because in this case, the answer comes like he doesn't, you know, sure, he doesn't adopt the kid or whatever, but he doesn't also, like, put him in jail or whatever, or leave him for the police, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, he doesn't see, well, now he's one of them. He doesn't necessarily, he knows better than that.
Yeah, and that comes from the connection, because he has, I mean, empathy, which is hard won, obviously, but I think that that's kind of a good parable for a kind of like military policing becoming a community policing, which is one of the things that we need to get back to if it was ever the case, which I'm sure it was. But, you know, obviously certain things happened in this country's history that people deemed it necessary to give the police tanks and things. And so mm-hmm. in this case, like he recognizes himself in this kid. And so that allows him to be, not merciful, but fair, like interested in justice rather than punishment, which is something that Wonder Woman will say in the next story. Whereas, you know, the Goyer Batman is just like, you know, it's hard to kind of think that he would do that. But that's, you know, that's a very interesting point that this story raises, that empathy is so critical, and connection, seeing criminals as more than their crimes, that is like so key to policing, and that honestly, like, I mean, this probably wasn't really happening in the story, but like, escalation and de-escalation, like the police and criminals are kind of an ecosystem, strangely enough. And that has to be kind of respected, and to push once and then you're going to get a push back. And so, you know, you got to be considerate even when you're putting your life on the line. And that's the other thing, too, is that with Superman and Wonder Woman, like these characters are immortal and invincible. So you are always thinking, well, why don't they just do literally everything? Batman's a little different. And I mean, one of my favorite details about this story, which I don't get from any of the movies, is his kind of tactical mind going into battles. Like he's like in two instances, he's like, you know, the guy shooting at my shadow, like that's what I wanted him to do. Or like at the cocaine factory, he's like, you know, there's this huge billow of cocaine. I probably should have worn a mask, but it still is good for cover. That's cool.
Oh yeah, I love that shit too. Yeah, he shoots my shadow just like I wanted, or like you know, like the adult is the leader. Like there's three coming out. You know, the smallest one is the lookout. Like and like this kind of like the I love the way his eyes are drawn in this, where you see him thinking. Even though he says he's thinking, but like you know, you kind of see him work.
Yeah.
And he's very like this is a very kind of down to you know back to basics Batman. There's not a lot of high tech technology besides you know his cables and his stuff like you know I don't even yeah you don't even see the car in this it's very very grounded so it's cool and like I mean I feel that like even though David Goyer is kind of a dick he did write the script of Batman Begins. There was that scene where like he you know showed like there's that kid who like was running away from his arguing parents, and Batman kind of showed him some sympathy and gave him a very expensive piece of equipment for no reason. But like that's the kind of thing where like it is very much like it's not doing this because I'm so angry. It's because I'm in this because I don't want anybody else to go through what I went through. Like, that really like has him you know have a war on crime. I mean in Kingdom Come, which Alex Ross did with Mark Waid. Superman says, if you strip away everything from Batman, the only thing left there is a person who does not want to see anybody die. And that finds itself in every other celebrated version of the character. Yeah. Because he was very redemptive. I mean, even in the 60s show, he was like, Catwoman, I want to redeem you and rehabilitate you. Of course, he was horny for her. But, like, there was that. Even in Batman Returns, he's kind of like that. So, like, I like that it's he's mad at crime, but he knows that like crime isn't you know absorbing of people. I mean, it's absorbing of people, but he doesn't miss the forest for the trees. Like there's that scene of him incognito, which is a detail I love when he does that at that sort of diner. It's this waitress, I've arrested her like you know a dozen times, and she'll probably be back on the street doing more crimes. But I understand how hard her life is, and there's a sad predictability to her situation, and so he sort of it's implied that he gives her like an overabundant tip and stuff. Like he, even if he's punching you as Batman, that doesn't mean that like that's his final thought on you. I think it makes sense because a lot of his animosity is towards the supervillains, the ones who kind of embody sort of the elemental characteristics of himself, like with the Joker and the Riddler, Two-Face, and all those other the sort of extra personalities that kind of basically show him that he's not the only one like that in Gotham. But that actually makes a lot more sense than, like, I hate, you know, this henchman who worked for... That never made any sense to me.
Right.
But it's cool. And I think that that the humanity in the character kind of shows our humane responses towards crime. Because, yeah, crime... The way that crime is sort of depicted, and I think we talked about this before, is that it's this sort of good and evil kind of thing. Like, crime is what evil people do, not an element of things that can kind of reach anybody at any time. It's sort of this sort of intangible spirit of I guess crime. I don't think a better word than crime. But, like, you know, like things that kind of just, you know... take away. Like, there's that scene where you see people in the hospital, people at graveyards, people in prison, people in insane asylum. Like that's what crime does to people. It's not you know the tool that evil people do to make us feel down or whatever. It's just the nature of crime, and that's what he's kind of fighting against. And that's why he says he can't win because it's more than just hurting people. But you know he's Batman, so he's going to try to do something eventually. so yeah, I think that like. Also, I also remember that, like, yeah, maybe he did adopt a street urchin to be Robin, but that kid did get blown up by the Joker, so maybe he won't do that again. Whoops. So it interacts, but like I think that like as sort of short, I don't even think this is short-sighted. Like I feel that like what do you think the story was missing that you think would have made it a smarter story?
I mean, it's a smart Alec answer, but just length. I mean, you really got to explore like what Bruce Wayne can do to for a community and how that would kind of affect Batman, and it would be kind of interesting because essentially you'd be playing those two, you know, quote unquote characters against each other, where Bruce Wayne is like, you know, taking that factory which had fallen into disrepair and become like this cocaine factory, and he's turning it around, and maybe that'll like create jobs or whatever. But then that doesn't leave anything for Batman to do, which is kind of an interesting thought. But you know, how do you really solve the drug epidemic? You know, it's like money on it. Like you just have to put money into schools, into infrastructure, and you have to really reevaluate the police. And of course, Batman is the stand-in for the police in this case. So reevaluate how you approach that problem. And I think that's done in this one. You know, I think he looks at the kid in a way that police should look at their suspects, because everybody's a suspect. But you know, obviously nothing is really solved at the end of the story, but I think that that's okay. There's more of an answer than in the Superman one, but however, that does require a bit of a simplification of the problem. And I think there's a little bit of danger in characterizing crime itself as a kind of like virus or like a ghost almost, that it's like this almost like a thing that is like created out of Gotham City. It's not like a system, but it's like I wish it was more about symptoms than kind of saying crime. Because like, you know, what is the world of drug dealing in Gotham City? Like what are the organizations and the families and who's involved from the actual city? Like what politicians are attached to which, you know, kingpins, whatever, like that kind of stuff. You can't really explore that much detail in a one shot. And again, like it's a shame that like, you know, all the Batman movies are going to be movies. So he's going to be fighting a super villain. You're not going to get a lot of attention on the street level. So you'd think like something like, the animated series or any long form thing like that would be the perfect medium. But then you look on TV and you see Gotham and it's like, it is the worst because that's like the way they characterize that city is just this fucking hellhole where all the crime is committed against just criminals just vying for control because this show wants to be Game of Thrones so badly. Like that just doesn't, it doesn't make any, nobody would live there and they would just, you should just blow it up with a nuclear bomb. Like that would be the actual solution. Like not to have this dickhead running around like an asshole trying to like, but anyway,
we had to record Gotham Chronicle a couple hours ago. So,
oh man, it's percolating.
And it was the worst episode ever. No, seriously.
Such a bad show. It's just such a horrible interpretation of the character. Like, because, you know, he's a kid. He's not really in it. But, you know, I think Batman needs to have a real Gotham City to interface with. And that's just not at all what's going on in that show.
Well, Gotham City is, you know, I'll people say, oh, it's just kind of this kind of like, you know, kind of this dark deco kind of apocalyptic place. Like, it was, I think I said this in podcast earlier today, that, like, the idea is that, like, during the day, it's like Metropolis is big, it's booming. You know, Wayne Enterprises has a lot of things going on. You know, it's monorail and all that kind of stuff from the movies. But like at night, it kind of becomes like, you know, the opposite of Metropolis. It's, you know, it is crime ridden and it's full of corruption and stuff. And even here, what I like is that like the guy Winters is like, you know, oh yeah, if there's anybody you don't want in these neighborhoods, you know, I can kind of just pay off the police.
Yeah,
and they'll take care of them. And Batman's like, or Bruce is like, I resist the urge to punch his lights out.
Yeah.
And then by the end, he's like, you know, yeah, oh yeah, I told Commissioner Gordon about you're paying off the cops, and he's like right over there.
Yes.
So that was awesome. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the movies have never really, there's never been a singular perfect. That's how Batman operates. I mean, all of them are missing something. I mean, the lazy critic will say, "Well, he's never a detective. He's always a detective in every one of them." But like, but they do kind of focus on one thing without, and that's why the animated series is so popular because it had like 85 episodes to portray every element of the character. You know, this is the urban version. There are no supervillains in this. You know, the only supporting characters are like Alfred in the, you know, in the corner of your eye, or Commissioner Gordon in a blinking miss it kind of panel. There's no real there's no back signal. There's not much of the iconography. Mm-hmm. There's hardly any batarangs, but like it's just the simple, which is so great. It's the simple nature of the idea of the character. I was reminded, there was an episode, there was a really early episode of the animated series where he loses his memory and is like kind of picked up by this sort of slave ring, where he's basically working in the sun with a bunch of like other kidnapped people for this, like, you know, this fat guy. And he over a dream, he kind of remembers who he is. And like, there's an image of like Bruce Wayne. The idea is that like all these kidnapped people are like people that are homeless. Like homeless people are getting kidnapped and forced into slave labor. And there was this dream he had where, like, as Bruce Wayne, people came up to him and asked him for money, and he would give them money. But, like, there were so many people that he didn't have enough money, and he started crying. And, like, that was their idea of, like, you know, kind of giving commentary on poverty, which is a little much. But I think that, like, visually it kind of worked, because it's the idea of, like, you know, if Bruce Wayne lives in a crime-ridden city, that there must be a lot of poverty there. So I always wanted to combat that. And I think that, like, that kind of exposes a selfish element to Batman that kind of makes him a lot more particular. But at the same time, you know, there is elements like the Wayne Foundation and in stories like this where he does decide to help develop Bayside, where those are eventually addressed whenever they think to do so. So it's like, as bad as Gotham is, Bruce Wayne kind of gives it hope, and because he hopes in people. It's not just his kind of, you know, godlike soul, fortunately.
Yeah. And so I think this is another character study, and it's about what the character has to kind of realize about the world and about himself. And that's kind of the ultimate suggestion of the story. Again, it's not something super practical because, again, we're not superheroes or millionaires. But what we can do as readers is have empathy. And so that's that's always a great note to end a story on. And in part, I mean, probably why storytelling exists or is worthwhile for whatever reason. That's a question we sometimes ask here, which is like, what's the point of storytelling? And honestly, like, you know, art as the medium of communication between people, like empathy just is a natural fit. And a very important thing that powers society. And so, for that to be, the ultimate message here, it's really good. And, it's an interesting exploration, even if I think it's kind of flawed in a few respects. Like, I think it works out.
Well, I'm kind of glad it is, because it would be annoying that like this story is this story had a more ideal approach to kind of combating crime, and then 25 years go by and this didn't really tell anybody, the writer, how to do it. That would annoy me. Because I'm thinking this is in the time that it was. The late 90s were a pretty good time for DC. There were some good stories. Generally, but like this is, I think, I don't know if any other story has kind of been about this. I mean, sometimes there are, but like it's never really been a whole story about it necessarily. And I like that he kind of muses, you know, would I do this if I was not as rich as I was? If I was like Marcus, who is the orphan in the story, like, you know, would I still fight crime, or would I want to kind of, would I end up falling into it?
Yeah,
and I think that's pretty cool. What did you think of Ross's artwork and how he depicted Batman in this?
It was really cool. I mean, I noted earlier that, like, you know, there's a more narrative focus on how he actually fights crime, which is just hard in general to get across in the movies, because it's Batman's kind of if you saw him for real, I don't think anybody would like shit their pants. So you really have to kind of illustrate that specifically, and I think he pulls it off here. He's like half in shadow, or he's like being consumed by the shadow. And it's very, I feel like sometimes you kind of see things from the criminal's perspective, and it works. Yeah. It makes sense even, like, in terms of like how this would work strategically. Cause I think he even says like that, you know, I mean, it's the classic Batman thing. Like, you have to, use the shadows and fear and stuff to your advantage. That's obvious, but it is illustrated here in a way that communicates it to the audience in a way that's more than just making it look cool, that it actually makes it practical.
You notice that, like, his cowl, the way that Ross draws it, is sort of like a second skin. Like, he has, like, black eyelids and stuff.
Yeah.
like, creases in his forehead. Kind of a funny thing. No, yeah, yeah, I kind of like that, because it's less like a mask and more kind of, I don't know, it doesn't make any sense, but yeah, he has money, he can make that happen. I do like the montages, kind of just show him, like, in the middle of the city street, kind of see him kind of fly by as he's saying, people tend to have glimpses of me, but nobody truly knows if I exist, even though there's so there's so much evidence that I do. and I like kind of the scenes of, like, kind of him looking on people. My favorite panel is that shot of him with, like, the man and the woman, like, the woman's tied up, and, like, he's kind of coming out of the light, and his cape's kind of billowing. That to me is like, oh, that's that good shit.
Yeah.
I do love that. There's a very famous image that Ross invented. It was kind of first remarked upon, like, out of shot. Like, there was a comic in, like, I think the 80s, where Catwoman saw his back, and it's like, I didn't know you had so much scar tissue, but you didn't see what she was looking at. But here, Alex Ross, there's a scene where, like, he goes to the Batcave and, like, kind of removes his suit, and you see all his body all scarred up. That was really, like, people saw that and was like, holy shit. So that was kind of, like, one thing that kind of people really, it really sparked the imagination that, like, you know, as perfect as he might seem, like we can kind of take off, you know, his costume, he's all kind of, like, tatted up, and, like, you can even see, like, a bite mark in his elbow or something like that. Yeah. Which is kind of neat.
It was the Bat.
Yeah, yeah, the Bat that bursts in his window is like, ah, shit, get this off. there was a meme going around a few years ago where, like, a zoo bat came into his window.
Oh my god! He'd be poisoned.
Yeah, super effective. Yeah, but, like, no, it's cool, and I like that. Like, he's basically wearing, because this is, like, Ross's idea of the character, but he's basically wearing, like, the new Batman Adventures design, which is basically the Batman animated series when it was on the WB in, like, 1997, but, like, it's all good. And I prefer the longer years to the shorter years, but,
yeah. Oh, definitely.
If we have any, unless we have anything else to say, we can kind of move on from Batman War on Crime to Wonder Woman Spirit of Truth.
Yeah, I think we probably can. I don't know if I have anything more to add.
All right, so this story is actually a lot more ambiguous in terms of what the point of it was.
Yeah.
Which is something that Dana Mike also remarked upon. But essentially, it's about Wonder Woman and kind of really either redefining or kind of narrowing down what exactly she can accomplish as Wonder Woman in man's world. She's stopping crime, she's saving lives, she's helping America. Or at least, not America, then just at least, you know, anywhere that's not Paradise Island. But she eventually, and it's again, it's pretty obvious it's China, she eventually encounters this sort of, you know, protest and these armed forces nearly destroying killing these protesters. And this woman reacts really badly towards her, kind of afraid of her. And Wonder Woman is completely perplexed. She's like, I'm not sure, I'm trying to do my best in helping people and show them the way and how humanity should act. I don't know why they don't follow my example. And she tries talking to, like, world leaders and stuff, but they don't really take her seriously. And eventually, she asks her Justice League buddy, Clark Kent, you know, how do you do this shit? Because, you know, you're Superman, you have a face that people see helping people, and you don't seem to have too many problems. And he's like, you know, like, look, what you ought to do is try to kind of involve yourself on the ground floor. You know, it's hard to care about things when you're far away in the sky. So Diana basically kind of goes incognito and kind of involves herself in certain protests, kind of involves herself in certain causes, at least tries to see how things are kind of corrupted or at least sort of interrupted when there are kind of innocent people across the world. She goes to rainforest and have people try to protest cutting rainforests down. She kind of tries to help out with that. She dedicates herself to, like, removing landmines and helping children who are affected by landmines. And she ends up in Desert Nations, as it's called, and goes incognito as a woman in a hijab. I hope that's the right word for it. Basically kind of demonstrates that there are either people or women who can fight back against oppressive forces. And that's kind of where the story ends. It is tough to kind of parse out a real moral or statement that this book is making. So I'm going to instantly ask you, like, what did you think about this story?
It's funny because I just feel it's kind of emblematic of the Wonder Woman character being just kind of enigma to creative people.
Yeah, totally. And even
to myself, like, I remember asking, like, what's a good Wonder Woman story, like, 10 years ago? And somebody said the Hitakea or the Hikiti.
I remember whatever. That.
And it was just so – it was awful. I hated it. I kind of gave up on Wonder Woman. But, I mean, that character is always going to be interesting to me because she's, you know, the woman. But this story, especially in the context of the other two, like, you know, in the Superman story, it was world hunger. In the Batman story, it was kind of like street crime and poverty. In this one, like, you don't really have a problem that she's trying to solve so much as what can she do to improve what she's already doing? And the answer is starting from the human's perspective. And I think that that's a pretty good moral. It tracks pretty closely to the one we just read with Batman, of course. But it's interesting, too, because it really answers her own situation as an outsider coming in trying to help out other people and being that kind of American interventionist. Like, what do Americans really have to do in Iraq aside from not be there? Well, they have to see things from the Iraqi civilian perspective and what can make their lives better. Does that mean this, this, and this? You have to put yourself in that perspective first. There's so much also that just feels like part of a gender conversation with this one, because she's in these various, not boardrooms, but like, I don't know what you call it, like
congressional
chambers.
Meetings and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Where all the men are like, oh, we're not taking her seriously. And meanwhile, she's wearing this like ridiculous costume that's like colorful and flowing. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously she stands out, but it's because, you know, in the context of the story, it's because she's a woman, I guess thematically.
They never come out and say that, but like, that's what the idea that you get.
I mean, you could never say that, probably still. I don't know. But, you know, that – and so I think the – like she feels like an alien. And for me, I read that as, oh, because she's a woman. So her answer is to kind of – I don't know exactly, because the answer doesn't really track with what women can do to be more or to have less sexism happen to them, which is essentially the answer to that has always been they shouldn't have to do anything. But of course, in this story, it's an active protagonist or whatever. So she gets help from a male ally it's funny because this one's the only story where another character really comes in and helps her out. But it's not like she's like so weak. She just needs like advice on how to be more human, really, because she's just too like godlike. And honestly, when she's in the Middle East and she's like floating in the sky, I was like, this is like straight out of Watchmen, and it's like, oh, the Wonder Woman is real, and she is American.
She's blowing up Viet Cong.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the moral is good. It's just a matter of like, what was it really answering? I think is kind of the question.
Yeah. I think it's apparent. I think 2 minutes on the story because I didn't know what it was about. But like, I think it's apparent that they like. Where, like, the previous characters lend themselves to addressing real-world issues. You could with Wonder Woman, but, like, Dini and Ross didn't. And I don't think it's a lack of interest in the character. I think it's just sort of, like, a lack of... Maybe it is kind of the fact that she is, you know, the woman. And Wonder Woman is, as you say, she is very difficult to depict in any sort of setting. Like, even in the Justice League series, had a tricky time kind of, like, getting... kind of grounding down and kind of... finding a rhythm with her character. You know, is she super smart? Is she a fierce Amazon warrior? Is she, like, you know, sort of like a goddess? Is she this? Like, she's actually a lot like a Black Panther in that, like, he's so many things that, like, if you don't do one of them, then it's not right. Or even kind of like Batman and Superman in a way. Like, she's kind of that sort of, like, a amalgam of ideas that is difficult to kind of parse out for a single specific story, while still feeling like it's staying true to her character, and that's tough, yeah. Because I don't know if she the story felt like it just kind of ended. Like, she was in a hijab with a bunch of women who were kind of being kidnapped. She took it off, beat these guys up, and says, "I am the spirit of truth." And I was like, "Why is this happening?"
Sure, but I think the difference is that I think the point of that is that when she reveals herself, people aren't running away scared because right. What's going through – she's having this monologue, which is like, I feel these people suffering. And obviously you could look at that and be like, come on, don't be ridiculous.
yeah, exactly.
But the point is sound, which is when you kind of exist alongside people, you're going to care about them more. And I think that's kind of like what scared the Chinese woman, or probably Taiwanese, I guess, when she lifted the tank. Cause like, that's not, she wasn't expecting that to happen. Like that wasn't in her matrix of possibilities. So that's going to put somebody off. Whereas if Wonder Woman is just in the crowd and she reaches out for a gun and breaks it, like that could inspire the people around her and be like, oh man, that's so cool. It's not scary. And it doesn't like challenge me. It's more empowering. And so I think that that's cool. But again, like it's like what the problem in this story is like, well, I guess that's it. Like that was the problem. That was the answer. But there wasn't anything broader other than what Wonder Woman should kind of be doing as a hero, which is still cool, but it didn't seem quite as far reaching as the other two.
It reminds me of what Alan Moore has said about the Killing Joke, and that like he doesn't really like it because it's about Batman the Joker and like nothing else. There's no real larger story he can bring from it. Also, they let him do things that he was surprised and kind of horrified they made him do. But
sure,
it's kind of more singular towards Wonder Woman as an idea than as a broader message. But I think the idea of action, you can find a message like it will. You can imagine how women might feel when one of them, who kind of shares the space of being captured, fights back from a guy who's about to slap her and then beats the crap out of him. Yeah. She might have been in there for hours, and like all of a sudden, like she ends up doing that and kind of just upends everything. That is interesting. But like kind of the Superman story, does she just go on with her merry way and leave that country the way it is?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little tough. I mean, it is interesting because even like as I'm looking at the scene now, and she leaves, they kind of nod and stuff, but they don't really change what happens with them. And she said she wasn't expecting it either, but it's hard to find the point in as the story ends, even if it is more towards kind of ground level interaction / intervention rather than performative works of heroism, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Not that she can. I mean, she's not trying to show off. She's.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's not her. But like, yeah. And I kind of liked how she was talking to Hippolyta, her mother, and Hippolyta was saying, "I don't understand. You're telling me you're doing all these things, but mankind still won't listen to you."
Yeah. And what does she say? She's like.
She says, "I'm going to the page." She says
they don't choose, or they choose what guides them individually.
Don't they logically recognize your benevolence and accept you as guide to truth and understanding? And she says, "I was embarrassed to know that mortals choose their own guides. Many times, neither logic nor benevolence is part of the equation."
And that's a really interesting and kind of the wrinkle that goes into superhero utopianism, which is. And really all, like, I mean, police shows are the same way, that, like, we trust the main character because they're just right.
Right.
That doesn't track with reality, not one iota. And in fact, it's the fallacy that kind of leads to a lot of tragedy, because people think they're so unflappable because they're doing a job that there's no self-criticism and no kind of oversight that would just be natural, you would think, to any individual who values their agency or whatever. But no, and so... it's an interesting line, and I don't really see how it connects to the story. It doesn't have to, but it's just interesting. But along that track, kind of in terms of characters, like the one thing that's missing in all these three stories, which I think are all generally optimistic, is the element of the thing that you miss by not having supervillains is kind of hatred or a strong emotional stake that complicates things. Because, I mean... Superman is like so determined to fight world hunger. Like there's no moral gray area there. That's a bad thing everybody agrees on. It's just a matter of doing it. And so one of the disheartening things that was dawning on me in like 2016 or last year too, as well, is when the fight became about Nazis, where before it was always Democrats versus Republicans and like, racists versus non-racists, even there was always a kind of sense of like, these people are still human.
Yeah.
When it's Nazis, like that conversation shifts and it becomes a lot more complicated, and the solutions then become more complicated. And so it's just, it's easy for these three heroes to kind of do their job, in these stories. And that's not always going to be the case with addressing world problems, I guess.
Yeah, essentially, and I think that, like, I don't know if a singular villain would have, like, sort of narrowed that down more so. Like, just kind of flex my muscles. Like, I don't know if you could have the Cheetah or Ares, God of War, or Cersei, or Dr. Poison, I think her name was, or Egg Foo, a giant egg with a mustache. I don't think you could have any of those villains sort of like narrow down an idea. More so, you can have villains for the other stories. But I think that like, if you were writing, I hesitate to do this necessarily, but like, if you had an idea for Wonder Woman's story, would it be sort of a Peace on Earth, sort of like, you know, using her to solve man's world's problems idea, or would it kind of just be kind of her just beating everybody up?
I mean, it would be both, but the end would be peace on Earth.
Right, yeah, exactly. Because that is her point. Like, she is supposed to be... I don't know why Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman is in man's world necessarily, but she's supposed to be there, literally, to kind of save the world. That is her mission from the Amazons. Like what they cut out of the Wonder Woman film is that there's this whole bullets and bracelets sort of a competition where they decide which Amazon goes there, and she won, and she's supposed to be there and live there to kind of basically turn man's world into Paradise Island or Themyscira. Mm-hmm. And you know, hence you have the whole series. And it's interesting because like visually this is very much like Harry Peter, who was the artist on the William Moulton Marston Golden Age stories. Like Hippolyta's dress looks very Golden Age, and if you notice when she's going back home with Themyscira, they're like riding kangaroos and stuff. I don't know what it is with like William Moulton Marston kangaroos.
They're sexy.
Yeah, that's the only explanation. But like, there's definitely some Golden Age references in this. Which and the Golden Age Wonder Woman is not often brought back or looked at for various reasons. but like, it's probably the one that's the closest to like this story in terms of, you know, not so much figuring out her place in the world, but kind of her solving the world's problems. I mean, that's what she was. The Golden Age stuff was explicit with that. So I feel that like either Marsden's Ghost or Grant Morrison would have kind of tackled this idea in a more kind of a specific way. Because like that scene at the end, I'm wondering if she would have kind of used that and kind of say, "Everybody listen to me," or if that's sort of the antithesis of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That would be kind of an interesting way to end it, seeing as how her voice has been sort of tamped down throughout by men in suits elsewhere, if she kind of became almost like a political leader or a voice in that way. But again, I mean, and this kind of strikes at the heart of the question, which is like, if superheroes were real, you know, what would that be like? Would the world be a better place? And so can one even superpowered person kind of turn it around? And what would that process look like? Like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that would be the answer. But I think that this story definitely leaves on a suggestion that in the future, she's going to kind of approach things from the ground up. And that's, I mean, it does kind of reiterate the Batman story for sure. But I think it's, I think it's, I don't know. I just like Wonder Woman, so it's cool.
It's
I don't
all
know.
Good.
Yeah, I guess.
It's all good in the hood. I mean, these characters are like, you know, long lasting, not for no reason.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you can have your preference, but like, I think that like at a certain point, you got to give them their props. As of today, it's been a week since Action Comics 1000 came out, celebrating 80 years of Superman's first appearance. So like, that's no other character's been around for that. But like, there was a scene. It was many stories in that. And the first story was how Clark Kent and Lois, because he and Lois are married with a child. Finally, and like the idea was that like how can he kind of live his life with his family while there's so many problems in the world, and like Wonder Woman showed him and says, you know, there are a lot of us other here, a lot of us else throughout the world, and you see like the whole DC universe basically showing to say hi. Harley Quinn like waves at him. It's like everyone's here to help you out. So it's like in a world with superheroes, the world probably would be a better place, but the idea is that like these kind of heroes kind of exist on their own, so it kind of narrows it down. How did you think Ross depicted Wonder Woman in this? Like it's definitely different than Gal Gadot. Like, did he do things that kind of sparked your imagination, or did you have other preferences? Like, what were you taking away from the artwork?
You know, I think with very few exceptions, I didn't really get a sense that we were looking at her in any way that was kind of untoward, which is, you know, cool. Like, it didn't occur to me until, like, midway into the story that, like, oh, yeah, this is Wonder Woman. Like, usually she's, like, the sexy character, but that didn't really occur to me, which is kind of a rare feat for Wonder Woman as you know, viewed through a male gaze, of course. And I mean, I think in this story, like, the fact of Wonder Woman being different shows through the most. Like, her costume is just so bright and colorful and different from everything else. And I think she's like wearing a tiara, maybe not. But that's part of the story, though, is her feeling kind of out of place. And so it makes sense. But also her face, like, she looks like Emily Deschanel almost. Like, she just looks very real.
She says those like blind looking eyes.
Yeah. But it's cool though. There's a lot of expression in that face. And, this is the only story that actually has dialogue though, which I thought was interesting. I would have preferred if it was more consistent. But it's still cool. I mean, she talks to Clark Kent, so I guess you couldn't just do that through gestures, but, I thought that was interesting.
We decided to use sign language, as was the Kryptonian / Amazonian way.
Yes.
Yeah, no, she's cool. Like Dan might point out there are a couple like butt shots, I think there are sometimes where you see kind of the back of her a lot, which is a little unfortunate. But like generally, she's not like a supermodel design. In the 90s, she was drawn by an artist named Mike Diodato Jr., who was very, very much kind of like a bad girl artist and kind of had her drawn very sexily, which was kind of ridiculous. There was a time period where like where a lot of characters were kind of having stand-ins for a while. Like Superman died, Batman got his back broken, so there was other people kind of stepping through their monikers. And Diana was fired essentially from being Wonder Woman, and her sister Artemis became Wonder Woman. She had like red hair and stuff. So Diana wore like a mini skirt jacket and hot pants and fought crime. because it was the 90s. But this is like, yeah, she's a powerful looking character.
Yes,
she's very tall. Like she's a full. I love the idea of a Wonder Woman as a true Amazon. Like the idea in Darwin Cook's New Frontier, she was taller than Superman. Like she's a very like kind of like a archetypal Wonder Woman who looks like she could lift a tank.
Yeah.
And that's always really, really cool.
That's what I'm talking about. One boob, arrows, no.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the whole when she stops bullets with her bracelets and stuff. That's the kind of like classic comic book stuff. But she's a really classic look. She looks like she kind of comes from like old timey movies almost.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of the way that her face is rendered. I don't know. It feels timeless, but also kind of classic in a way which doesn't feel forced, but kind of evokes that idea.
Yeah, I mean, when I was reading these, I could not even guess at when they were made, just because they do have that timeless quality. Like, I would have said maybe, like, honestly, like 60s, which is ridiculous because that's when it kind of started. But it just seemed like definitely older. So I was kind of surprised when it ended in 2001. Like, that seems it wasn't recent, but it seems that way.
Yeah. I think Ross absolutely has a very classic look to all of his characters. Like his Spider-Man looks very much like a Steve Ditko, John Romita kind of hybrid of the 60s era. And same thing with like Iron Man, and like he doesn't really tend to draw a lot of like modern versions of characters. In fact, like for a while he kind of protested, like if he was going to draw the Flash or Green Lantern, there would be like the classic version, not the modern versions. Like for a long time, he refused to draw Dick Grayson as Nightwing because his mind, Dick Grayson was only Robin. So he was like he grew up on the Super Friends, so the Super Friends is like his ideal versions of those characters. Which, as you might imagine, people make fun of. Like Paul Dini and Bruce Timm make fun of him about that and the Superman anime series commentary DVDs, which is pretty cool. But like when we see Clark Kent, he has a hat and like wears those kind of round glasses. It looks like it's right out of like the serials, which I love. I love that shit. But like, it's kind of cool that way. And like, I think Wonder Woman, she wears earrings in this.
Nice.
Kind of like because I like her kind of star earrings. But like, it's cool. I think that like, her eyes are awfully bright. But I think that's the idea that she has these big, beautiful blue eyes.
Yes, indeed. At least she's not blonde.
Yeah. It's all good.
That'd be weird.
She doesn't. Yeah, she doesn't. I mean, the idea is that she doesn't really necessarily evoke a Mediterranean look to her, because Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman is the first ever, I think, to my mind, ever even hint of an accent. It's like Wonder Woman has kind of generally been portrayed as like somebody who is ideally Americanized, even though she's not.
So, right.
So this one's kind of like that, but like I'm only thinking about that now because we've had Gal Gadot. Otherwise, I wouldn't even bring it up.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was kind of first learning about the character, like the idea that she comes from a magical island was like, what? She's not like this all-American girl? Like, I didn't quite get that, but that's interesting. But yeah, I mean, I think, and honestly, like to kind of round it back and give a bit of redemption to the most recent DC movies, like I do appreciate that Zack Snyder has an appreciable style, and I do like that style. You have like these really just, there's a lot of gravity with his characters, like they seem to exist in space in a way that's interesting. Even though there's like a ton of CGI, there's still a bit of weight and the way he shoots movies and stuff. So I think that, you know, in terms of this having a classical style but also timeless, like you need that, I think, for I mean anything really. But sometimes I think, you know, the Christopher Nolan movies were like so hardcore realistic that you didn't really have that. It was more like the storytelling itself was a bit more stylish. If the production design was more muted, it's interesting because it's like you kind of want to tell a story about the world if you're going to tell a story about saving it, but you need to kind of, maybe it's kind of like it's telling that you need to contextualize outsized heroes in an appropriately outsized world, and that's kind of why it's hard to analogize or take things, specific things from these stories, which is why you end up doing more character studies and concluding, you know, what do you have to do to one day solve this problem? And I'd love to see that story, but you know, I would just have to. I'm sure they exist, but I would have to explore more.
Yeah, I mean, these characters have so much history behind them that there's a lot of ways they've been kind of explored invariably. Like I feel that like Batman. Year One was the first time that like police corruption was seriously kind of not only undertaken but kind of assumed as like, you know, the status quo for Gotham City, which makes a lot of sense, which makes them needed in that city. But like there are all these elements, you know, like why don't they kill her, or why should they kill her, or whatever, or would they, you know, in this sort of sense, it's like what would they do in real world situations. But I don't know, like I feel that like there was a famous story, I think it was Superman 900, where he went to interfere in an international situation, similar to kind of these stories, and they said, "Well, you can't do this because this you're seen as a product of America, and or representative of America, so you can't do this without political repercussions." And he says, "All right, fine. At this moment, I'm renouncing my American citizenship." As you might imagine, that didn't leave people with a lot of like positive feelings.
Oh man, haven't they never seen 24? And how far Jack Bauer goes beyond America to save America?
You know who wrote that story?
No.
David Goyer.
Oh my goodness. That's interesting though. I didn't know that.
It all comes back screaming. I mean, I don't know if that's still in continuity now. I don't think it's ever been referenced before or since. Or I should say since, but like, yeah, like 10 years ago, that was boy, people were upset. I didn't necessarily care, but like, I thought it was funny how people got mad.
Yeah.
I have one kind of final question for the whole of the story, and we've kind of been referencing it, or we're kind of pooling towards it every now and then. As you say, these stories are very international, and it kind of involves a lot of like the heroes kind of involving themselves in the lives of people that are certainly not necessarily in sort of their weight class, you know, abilities wise or status wise or whatever. I mean, do you think there's a certain sense of like, I think maybe Peter had once said like a kind of like, you know, going to help out African people and kind of taking pictures with them, sort of idea of it, like, sort of like white American interventionist, like, you know, we can solve the problems kind of thing. Just by the nature of how American these characters are, was there any sort of sense of, like, you know, well, this is a little too trite to kind of really play or kind of fall into? Did that ever occur to you at any point in time?
A little bit with the Wonder Woman thing, just because I think she brings it up. And I think largely it is a matter of tone that you don't specify the kind of geopolitical aspects of it. You don't name countries or anything like that. You allude to it. And so you can kind of imagine that this is a world away from our own a little bit. And maybe that softens the blow. But, you know, the problem with American interventionalism or interventionism is not itself necessarily, but how it's been done. And so I think with these stories, like, this is how you would do it generally. And so it's not so much that they are American and that's the problem. It's just, you know, Americans suck, but these guys seem to have it going on.
Right. Yeah. They don't tend to care about American being so great. Like the original Superman mantra from the serials was, or the cartoon serials, the animated serials, the Fleischer cartoons, was a beacon of truth and justice. And I think it was a radio show that added it the American way. And since then, that's kind of, you know, it's going back to truth and justice. And people are like, you know, why should it be the American way? Because that's what it is. It's like, well, you know, technically. But yeah. There is an idea of how, I don't know, patriotic or nationalistic they should be. Because DC Comics is like the classic superhero company. Like, it's a lot more traditionalist than Marvel is. So, like, that kind of tone kind of dips in force every now and then, but it does depend. And these characters have never really given a shit, unless it was World War II, where, like, you see Batman and Robin and Superman selling war bonds and gunning down Japanese Nazis with their Gatling guns.
Yeah.
You know, when that happened. But, it's just something that kind of came to mind with these three. Are these a little too pleased with themselves? And I think that Dini is a smart enough writer to kind of avoid that, but he's still kind of a white guy, so I don't know. I don't know if that just kind of like ended up that way unintentionally or not. And I'm glad that you kind of spoke about that.
Yeah, I wasn't getting anything weird. No weird vibes from it, really.
Gotcha. All right, so I usually say this, but they're ready in the show. But is there any kind of final thought you have in terms of, like, you know, these three stories? It sounds like you generally enjoyed them. Is there anything else you want to kind of say before we kind of leave this episode?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of wish that they existed in a context that kind of followed up and that there were stories to go from here.
Yes.
I maybe with Wonder Woman, probably that one is more connected to other Wonder Woman stories, if she does kind of follow that method, which is kind of like the stealth game versus like just shooting everybody, which is interesting. But I mean, at the same time, like, I guess they kind of exist in the continuity that comics always exist in, which is these stories really capture the spirit of the character, and that's what's kind of carried through no matter what happens or who's writing it or whatever. Like, this story always happens in Wonder Woman or in Superman, even if it doesn't specifically happen. Like, he's always going to have thoughts like these and approach problems this way. And that's just cool from a kind of storytelling perspective as we kind of grapple with how we deal with continuity, which is always seems to be like an American problem. Like, the Japanese don't give a fuck about continuity. Reboot things, and it's crazy, but, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It lends, you know, these characters even more of a mythological feeling, which is cool.
Yes, exactly. I agree. I think that, like, I feel that, like, the people's idea of DC Comics, this is kind of that way. It's a very modern take on what they kind of used to be, because they're so continuity laden now that, like, there was a time where they kind of take some time out and kind of tell these stories. Mm-hmm. Alongside Detective Comics number whatever, or Superman the Man of Steel whatever, or Justice League Task Force Extreme number whatever, when that was a thing, you know, during those shames. But I enjoy this story, and I think while they're not while they're not perfect, I appreciate what kind of, you know, kind of like, as we talk about the sort of character study that they kind of portray, and varying qualities to be sure. But I like the fact that like they kind of, the writing generally lives up to the artwork, which I think is virtually peerless.
Yeah, totally.
I remember like at Comic-Con last year, there is a booth for Alex Ross's artwork. He wasn't there. I don't know if I've ever seen him, but like in person. But like he still does stuff like this, where it's like, you know, kind of just big paintings of the classic version of the characters. They look like this still, and they sell for a lot of money. So like I know that at the bottom of this was a lot of the original artwork for this was donated to the proceeds of like a September 11th charity event for the victims of the terrorist attack. So
wow,
it's good to see kind of this kind of being done in all the right ways and not just, you know, sold on eBay for. for whoever, comic book guy.
Yeah.
Although Satea's people were grateful for my help, I wondered if it wasn't I who should be grateful. They reminded me of the saying, evil triumphs when good men do nothing. I won't forget it again.
Yeah, so I guess we can kind of put a pin in this here. Did you want to have a short convo about the next episode, or you kind of just want to kind of preview that and end it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I wish I had come up with a question, but one of the big news stories today, which is, I mean, still ongoing, I guess, was the attack in Toronto, which was a few days ago, if not weeks, I think today it came out that, like, officially that it was about misogyny and being an incel and all that stuff. It's really creepy and disheartening. But a lot of women are saying, like, you know, this is extra sad because, like, we've been talking about this forever and it seems like nobody listens, but this is like a real problem. And one of the words that was used a lot in an article I read was radicalization. And I think it is kind of time that we start thinking in those terms, which is kind of the opposite to how I feel like I would generally approach things, which is against labels. But, to think about people as potential terrorists, like, obviously that sounds incredibly fascistic, like post-9/11. But I guess it would just kind of be taking something more seriously than maybe we would have. I don't know what the question is yet. But generally speaking for now, I think the next episode is going to be about incels and maybe how we can kind of intervene on that problem before it becomes violent. Looking at a case study like Elliot Rodger, for example, would probably be a major part of it. So yeah, that'll be for next week. And before we go, I didn't want to really append this to like the beginning, just cause I didn't want to throw the podcast off or derail, I've just been thinking about stuff lately. My own comments on this podcast, like asking you if Rose McGowan was the originator of the Me Too movement, was just like, the originator was this woman called Tarana Burke. She's on Twitter. But I've been watching the show Citizen Rose, which is like a 5-part E miniseries that's going to air soon. And there's a scene where she is speaking at like a Barnes & Noble somewhere.
Yeah.
And a trans woman is like, you know, you don't, like, you're trans misogynistic, like, you're emblematic of white cisgender or white cis feminism, and Rose McGowan's like, get the fuck out of here, and everybody's like applauding, and irrespective of Rose McGowan, the character or the persona or the show itself, like, I think trans misogyny is a bigger issue than I've previously understood it to be, that people can kind of accept radical feminism as feminism in a lot of cases. And I just want to make it clear from my end that my position on this is that if you are a self-identified TERF, and if you go online and bully trans women and trans men, you are responsible for suicides. And I know that for sure. That's not an opinion. I'm not trying to say you need to die or go away or you don't count, because I know that that's tone policing has a certain value, I guess, in terms of keeping people in a conversation, sure. But the fact of the matter is that your words do have consequences. And I guess that's pretty much it.
Okay. Yeah. That have we talked about this one? Because I remember when that happened on the news, reading it and just kind of thinking this is an incredibly unfortunate situation. And like that sounds kind of that sounds like I'm kind of, you know, kind of shooting it with a kind of hands off kind of situation. But like, no, really, like I remember that the word unfortunate was in my head when I was reading it. It's like, you know, this is something very important that Rose McGowan is kind of trying to talk about, that like, that to react in the way that she did when something's come up like this, it just kind of makes losers out of everyone. And yeah. I was talking about that with a coworker when her book Brave was on our 40% off bookseller table. I think it was like literally like the next day. I noticed it and kind of brought it up with a coworker, and he was like, "Yeah, man, I saw you share that news on Facebook." And it's like, yeah. It's wild.
Yeah. I mean, I totally understand it though, because I mean, she is such a victim, and I don't mean to sound pejorative or sarcastic, but she's dealing with trauma that I don't understand. So I just have to take her word for it. But yeah, to have somebody like, she kind of sees it as an attack. Like I get it, but, I think I was kind of recoiling in horror at the reaction that like, this person, the trans woman speaking out, which I mean, like, do that better, I guess, but still, like, that she is just escorted out as this like disruptive person. Like, she is the disruption to feminism. Like, that is just, I'm kind of recognizing that that's a much broader held opinion than I realize, and it's really crushing.
Okay, so the idea of next episode. No, it'll just be cut out. We'll be like incels and kind of how men can become, you know, the Elliot Rodgers and van driving people of, you know, what we're dealing with in the here and now. Kind of exploring and kind of investigating that.
Involuntary celibate, I guess I should.
that's true. It's kind of a fresh term. Mm-hmm. If you guys like to send in feedback, email at qnoanswers@gmail.com. Send us post a comment on our website under the episode postings or on our Facebook page. And until the next time, keep on reading comics that are good. And watching superhero movies that are good. Shit, as of this recording, tomorrow I'll be seeing Avengers Infinity War. And my brother actually texted me like an hour ago saying, like, do stay off YouTube. I was like, oh, God.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, this is a big one, people. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Bye, everybody.
Night later.
I spent a year in a fortress. Solitude, I'ma do my targets. And Brainiacs won't take my cake, but got a million on sponsored thanks to targets. And three beers, time to take their porridge. Gold I got on lock. Man is still latin' them. Record selling Phantom with brown skin optics. From Krypton BK to home where the art is. Lex Luthor gun stop with the offers. I make news happen. Take a picture with a Parker. Came from the dead. Take a picture with an author. And we are not the same, I am a Martian. Mailman and Clark Kent came up and often. I often x-ray right through they talking. Hawking, yo, it's a bird, it's a plane. I'm McBain on steroids. Jet sound like Elroy, fame like Elroy. All American, red cape, blue jeans. I beam Vizine, take a trip to the dark side. TJ since birth on earth, you could call me the smart guy. I ain't a perv, but I made hawk thighs. The lowest lanes on point with my arrows. Sorta like Hawkeyes. I'm getting cheese like some barrels. I fuck guys, they didn't last with a pharaoh. I'm doing more than just travel, like years of GCs. Shouts out to DC, bars from the moon, of course, my thoughts ET. Eradicate the calm, doomsday took a lot, but my aerials proved bigger in my farm. We all getting signed, Gambit, aka Rich Kant, damage, trick cards, and now Candace. Fast so I vanish, without a trace, page four of my canvas. What? So I'm laced, and I'm around for good, so please feel safe. Fast like a speeding bullet, large jumps in a single bound, Metro Crown, Superman.